we're also asking our membership to prepare to set the groundwork for a future city council run as well. So
So
that's a
you're
big
talking
goal.
about Salem DSA, am I right?
Yeah.
Which is the Democratic Socialists of America, which
That's
helped
right.
elect four city councilors, your
That's right.
co-leaders in
That's right. So
Portland.
we're getting inspired by that work
Yeah.
to prepare our own run as well.
So overall, how would you both encourage our listeners to get involved in the struggle to stop ICE and Trump's deportation drive, either through their labor unions or in other ways?
Back in February, the AFL-CIO released a frontline solidarity toolkit for unions. It's a specific, more specifically, it's a mass deportation fight back toolkit for union activists and organizers. So anyone can request the PDF of that through their website. It's a really good resource.
Great. AFL-CIO website. Thank you. Gio, do you have something to add about
Totally.
how our listeners can get involved with the struggle?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. I would suggest, like, as for anybody, building a rank and file caucus in your union that will promote class struggle demands like abolishing ICE and ending forever wars. I will always make the pitch for folks to join a Democratic mass member organization like DSA to build cross-sector working class movements. And engaging in mass politics by building coalitions with community organizers. One of the things that I forgot to mention is if folks want to get plugged into the work that we are doing by supporting like our petition or anything like that, feel free to get in touch with us, info@salemdsa.org or email, or just visiting our website, salemdsa.org, to find our petition and help us by signing it.
Well, that wraps it up for this evening's show. You've been listening to Nydia Caballero, a union electrician, and Giovanni Tolentino of the Hillsborough Education Association. I'm Jamie Partridge. This is Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
KBOO.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
Okay, we're talking today with Laura Neldoza from the Oregon Food Bank, who helps create public policy statements and was active in the filing of an amicus brief to the U.S. Supreme Court in the recent Grants Pass decision, City of Grants Pass versus Johnson.
Of course. Well, maybe I'll start by introducing myself. I am Laura Neldoza. I'm a public policy advocate with Oregon Food Bank, and was one of the authors of an amicus brief, or a brief that's filed with the Supreme Court to support Gloria Johnston and all of those who are similarly situated with her experience with homelessness down in Grants Pass and across Oregon. Oregon Food Bank, we really care about housing because there's a very strong intersection between housing insecurity, homelessness, and the prevalence of hunger. And Oregon Food Bank, we have worked for the last, you know, how long we've been around, 40 years, fighting to eliminate hunger, but also its root causes, right? And housing, whether it's the cost of housing, the stability that you have in your housing, the accessibility of your housing, these are all root causes of hunger when your housing situation is less than ideal, right? And the prevalence of hunger in Oregon has been increasing. Last year, Oregon Food Bank, we saw 1.9 million visits to food assistance sites through all of our network. That's a 14% increase from the previous year. And even though we've collectively moved on from COVID as a society, the crises that we're experiencing, that we've experienced during COVID, they haven't gone away. And it's gotten a lot worse in the last few years. And because we're seeing rates of hunger in Oregon continue to rise, and they're rising beyond numbers we've seen during the pandemic, right? This is precisely the worst time to be coming to this conversation about whether local governments should have the ability to criminalize the mere status of homelessness. And we're seeing that, unfortunately, across the country, not just in Grants Pass, but in cities across the country. Unfortunately, you know, it's just not going to solve anything. It's going to make matters a lot worse.
So, Lauren, let's talk about the case itself.
Yeah. So back in April, the Supreme Court heard this case, City of Grants Pass versus Johnson. And the court was asked to decide whether local governments, essentially whether local governments can criminalize sort of the indicia, the evidence, or, you know, status of homelessness by completely barring, in some cases, individuals without access to shelter from even being within the jurisdiction. The whole case concerned an ordinance that was passed by Grants Pass in 2013. And on its face, you know, just by looking at the ordinance itself and the way that folks are talking about it, the ordinance looks a lot like it's just prohibiting camping. But how camping is defined within the ordinance was sweepingly broad. A person in this case camps, quotes, camps whenever they occupy a space where bedding, sleeping bags, or some other material is used for bedding purposes. So what that means is that it can include as little as a blanket or a folded up piece of clothing that you use even temporarily as a pillow. If you're keeping a blanket around you to stay warm in Grants Pass, that could potentially fall within the scope of camping in Grants Pass. You know, it's complicated, but its effect essentially prohibits, in many cases, people from even existing and experiencing homelessness at the same time while being in Grants Pass. And what's even worse is that it applies whether or not there is any shelter capacity for that person. So what's one to do, right? At the time of the argument, and I believe it's still the case, Grants Pass doesn't operate any shelters. There's an 18-bed shelter that's run for unaccompanied minors, and there's a transitional housing program that limits stays up to, I think, 30 days with work requirements. But apart from that, at least from a 2019 point in time count, in Grants Pass, there were around 600 people experiencing some degree of homelessness. And there was about 1,000 people who were, quote, precariously housed. So a sort of spectrum of housing instability, right? So what is a person to do? I mean, with this ordinance in place, right? Your first option is to leave Grants Pass. And for a lot of people experiencing homelessness, Grants Pass is home. So the first option might not be ideal. The second option is to stay in Grants Pass, and you can the enforcement of that ordinance. So what happens with the ordinance, every time you're found violating this, quote, camping prohibition, you're going to be slapped with almost a $300 fine. I think it's $295. And if you get two of those fines, a police officer may then issue an exclusion order that essentially renders you guilty of criminal trespass if you remain on public property. And each count of criminal trespass is punishable with up to 30 days in jail and a fine, I think, of $1,200, right? And these punishments can add up. And in some cases, they can pile up within the course of a single day. So knowing that this case was likely going to be, and it turned out, yes, it was, the most important housing-related case in over 4 years, we filed an amicus brief with the court, along with a bunch of other Oregon direct service providers, advocacy organizations. Some names you might be familiar with: Cascades AIDS Project, Hygiene for All, Community Alliance of Tenants, Sisters of the Road, Habitat for Humanity, and a bunch of others. We made a point. We only made 2 points to the court because there are a bunch of other amicus briefs that were filed as well. the first point that we made is that homelessness is not a choice. It's an involuntary, temporary state of being. And that by criminalizing that status, you only make worse the circumstances that a lot of people find themselves in. You make them saddled with debt, right? Through cities imposing fines and through creating criminal records. And in many cases, you know, denying accessible and affordable healthcare, which in many cases are not available through departments of corrections. So last week, the court issued their opinion after they heard the oral arguments in April. And the opinion is terrible, to say the least. So, you know, lawyers will tell you there's going to be more litigation to come, right? But from the non-lawyer standpoint, from my position as a public policy advocate, there are a lot of takeaways, right? So the Supreme Court said criminalization, at least the way that Grants Pass does it, is not cruel or unusual, right? The first takeaway from this, from a public policy standpoint, is, you know, if Grants Pass doesn't violate the Constitution through their ordinance, Grants Pass is only going to then be one city among many cities that will soon pass the same terrible, we can call it anti-existence ordinances, like the one in this case. And in addition to upholding these laws, you know, the Supreme Court, by giving the green light to every city in the country to do the same, there's an even more harrowing thought in all of this, which is, if the Grants Pass ordinance is not cruel and unusual punishment, then what is? And I can imagine that some cities may test those limits by enacting something that's even more oppressive than the law in Grants Pass. More jail time, potentially, more fines. The realm of possibilities isn't set by Grants Pass. It's only creating a mile point, a milestone, where, you know, maybe cities can go beyond that. And certainly cities will test those limits. The second point is, you know, and this is sort of the silver lining to this case, that, you know, if an ordinance doesn't violate the Constitution, elected representatives and appointed officials could decide this policy in a different way, right? Just because a city is able to criminalize the status of homelessness doesn't necessarily mean that they will or should, right? And in Oregon, for our case, we've enacted a statewide policy in 2021 through a bill called HB 3115. And that bill, in many ways, enshrines much of the judicially made protections that we saw in Grants Pass when it was decided at the Ninth Circuit, and in another case called Martin versus City of Boise. And just, you know, despite the Grants Pass case and the outcome there, Oregon still has those protections for people experiencing homelessness. It is worrisome, though, you know, with other states with no protections like the ones we have, there is no silver lining for those states, right? But Justice Gorsuch, who wrote the majority opinion, he wrote specifically that Oregon has 3115, HB 3115. And, you know, states could specifically address how far municipalities may go in regulating public camping. His words, public camping. And nothing in the decision prevents states from doing that.
Again, we're talking with Lauren Naldoza from the Oregon Food Bank about the recent U.S. Supreme Court case criminalizing homelessness. It was based out of the case itself was based out of Grants Pass, Oregon.
Yeah, so HB 3115 in many ways codifies a lot of what was decided in City of Grants Pass versus Johnson at the Ninth Circuit level, and Martin versus City of Boise. And that bill passed in 2021 really gets at sort of like time, place, and manner restrictions. So a city or county that does decide to regulate acts of sitting or lying or sleeping or keeping warm, they must be objectively reasonable as to time, place, and manner with regards to people experiencing homelessness. And, you know, the language in HB 3115 is pretty vague. And it takes a lawyer to explain to you, you know, like what does reasonable mean, right? I'm not a lawyer myself, but you know, reasonable means so many different things, right? And that's to be litigated. But yeah, I mean, it sets at least a floor for people experiencing homelessness in terms of protections, right? But like with many laws, they're only as good as they're enforced. You know, the city of Grants Pass and their ordinance can be enforced at a certain level, and you know, House Bill 3115 can be enforced at a certain level, right? But the way that 3115 kind of envisions this is that, you know, many people will be going through the criminal legal system in one way or another. You know, City of Grants Pass could potentially, you know, keep their ordinance as it currently exists right now until, you know, somebody brings a lawsuit and says, actually, no, this is unreasonable time, place, and manner restrictions under 3115. But, you know, with the Supreme Court ruling, like they were only focusing on the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. So it's a little bit different posturing that needs to be considered. But, you know, across the Pacific Northwest, you know, and also I would include California into this model as well, there are a lot of elected officials from a public policy standpoint, which is kind of where I'm sort of talking from. It is troubling to see how many cities who are interested in copying or expanding on the City of Grants Pass ordinance. You may have seen that the City of San Francisco has been thinking about this as well. They wrote an amicus brief of their own saying that, you know, the City of Grants Pass decision at the Ninth Circuit level, they said by restricting San Francisco's ability to enforce their own criminalization laws, were for some reason thwarting their ability to provide services to persons experiencing homelessness, right? And we also see this with, you know, other amicus briefs from Oregon organizations on the other side of this argument. There was an amicus brief that was passed, or that was filed, saying criminalization and the use of law enforcement is really important. They called it a tool, right? A tool that's available to local governments for tackling this complex and troubling human issue, as a quote. But then you contrast that with, you know, if you look back at 2013 when this ordinance was passed, Lily Morgan, who was the council president at the time they enacted this ordinance, she said that the point, and I'll quote this, the point is to make it uncomfortable enough for them being people experiencing homelessness in our city, so they will want to move on down the road. But these two statements, right, these are very, how do you reconcile these two statements, right? The answer is you really can't. One has to be true. And if you look at the policy that Grants Pass has enacted, because people this ordinance targets presents them with a very impossible decision, right? Leave or stay, either way, it's going to be a problem. The intended effect must be to exclude people, right? And I think, you know, there are going to be lawyers who will analyze the legal impact of this case. But the public policy consideration that I am afraid of, and I think we should all be afraid of, is that the Supreme Court has given every city in the country the permission to opt out of its duty, I would call it a duty, to protect and support their constituents, especially those who are in the greatest of need. And by doing that, the Supreme Court has allowed cities to push that responsibility onto, I'd say, the remaining cities whose governments are, I would say, reasonable enough not to criminalize homelessness as well. And, you know, the future is hard to predict in some cases, but I think here we're going to see a pretty dynamic change, or at least a fortification of what it means to be poor in the United States. If you lose your job, if you lose a loved one who was the primary income earner in your household, if you get in an accident or you get sick enough that you can't work, and as a result of that, if you lose your home because you can't work, your city may then respond to your hardship, not by helping you out, but by issuing you a fine that you can't pay, or throwing you in jail by giving you a criminal record they reduce your income earning potential. I mean, how any of that is supposed to solve homelessness in the United States is beyond me. But, you know, as we're seeing at Oregon Food Bank, a higher increase in hunger through, you know, higher demand for our services. And even though we've sort of moved on from COVID, the issues around the cost of living in Oregon, the cost of living in general, has not gotten better. It's gotten a lot worse. And because we're seeing these rates of hunger in Oregon continue to rise, it is a duty that cities should not give up. And I think we need to be looking at this from more of a care standpoint and less of a criminalization standpoint.
This is the Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. Lauren, so one of the criticisms that I've heard of the case, part of what I've heard, I mean, we all know what kind of a court this is. It's a very bad court for liberal interests and also just for freedom in so many different kinds of ways. But one of the criticisms I have heard of the case was that it was going on the Eighth Amendment, the cruel and unusual punishment, because it the argument I've heard is basically that it doesn't really constitute punishment. I mean, the punishment of being arrested is the punishment, but the cruel and unusual punishment is meant to address what happens after someone gets arrested. So, I mean, obviously, you and I both agree that it's treating somebody like an animal, making them live outside with no shelter, with no food, with no clothing, in the cold, is inhumane and should be, you know, a right to housing should be a fundamental right of our Constitution. But how do you address the criticisms that were made about the case regarding the cruel and unusual punishment argument aspect of it, the Eighth Amendment appeal, which is the one that the court rejected?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good question for a lawyer, for sure. But I think from the standpoint of a layperson, I think it is very troubling, right? That there is I think that the cruel and unusual punishments clause, at least from the layperson's standpoint, is a protection for all of us to be protected from the criminalization of a potential status that we may have. You know, back in April, I listened to the oral arguments, and one of the cases that I heard our side raise was a case called Robinson, which had to do with, I believe it was a case in California where either a local or state government was trying to criminalize the status of being addicted to drugs, essentially. And, you know, the way that the Supreme Court ruled on that, from the way that I heard about it, was that, you know, the status of somebody, whether it's temporary, self-inflicted, or if it's a way that you can criminalize somebody just for being a certain way or from suffering from a certain, is unconstitutional and cruel and unusual.
Right.
It's hard to, you know, reconcile being addicted to drugs and experiencing homelessness, because those two things are very, very different, right? You may be experiencing both of those things at the same time. But the case law, you know, especially with the way that the court is set up, it's hard sometimes to see how much success a cruel and unusual punishments clause argument can, you know, really get through, especially as you mentioned with the way that the Supreme Court is set up right now. Luckily, we do have other recourses. I mean, we can, somebody can sue under House Bill 3115. And I think that is probably the best way that we can litigate this now, again, from a non-lawyer standpoint, because we now have express language from Justice Gorsuch saying that, you know, Oregon has a law of their own. Why don't you litigate it under those grounds? And we're not deciding now to restrict the way that states can handle cities. And, you know, in Oregon, we have, in many cases, a history of, you know, telling cities that, you know, you have to do certain things in a certain way. I mean, look at our, you know, land use system that we created in 1973. That's something that, you know, cities and counties can't necessarily rebut. We can do the same thing with the experience of homelessness, basically telling people, or not people, but cities and counties, you cannot opt out of a statewide plan to end homelessness.
Well, the good news is that we do have something that can be a challenge to this. I mean, it's interesting because the court itself and their like bogus originalist framework, which they claim is the foundation of a lot of these rulings, is based on the mythology that they're basically giving rights back to the states, which is the same kind of argument that they used in the Dobbs decision. So it's not a surprise that Gorsuch would, you know, point to a law that the state of Oregon does have. This court has been quite contradictory in its rulings, and I could easily see a challenge to, you know, to this the Oregon law going back to the Supreme Court. But let's hope that doesn't happen. In the meantime, what's some good news right now for folks who are experiencing houselessness? What are some takeaways that we can look at from this that like are about, you know, maybe some positives that we can sort of close with? Is there anything good to talk about?
I sure think there is. You know, we have a governor right now, and we have elected officials that have focused a lot on housing, right? In 2021 through 2024, there have been massive investments in housing. Even in 2020, you know, when at the height of COVID, right? We have been spending a bunch more on very needed, I would say very needed programs like emergency rental assistance, which the state has not really spent a whole bunch on in years before COVID, but now it's becoming a commonplace investment, which I'm very happy to see. There are a lot of other programs, a lot of other investments that are being made around the development of new affordable housing, which is something that we really desperately need. I mean, in the city of Grants Pass, for example, it was argued at oral arguments that, you know, one of the reasons why it's so hard for somebody experiencing homelessness in Grants Pass to find housing is that the vacancy rate in Grants Pass is nearly 0%. So by developing new places to call home, and by the legislature investing more money into that goal of creating more units for Oregon, that's very positive. There's a continued need, I'd say, for preserving existing affordable housing that we already have. We've seen apartment complexes. There is one called Wood Spring in Washington County where their affordability restrictions lapsed, and the property was at risk of, I think it was in 23 or 22, at risk of going market rate. So, you know, making sure that we keep the housing affordable that we develop is really important. And, you know, with the city of Grants Pass too, I mean, one of the things that I'm really hopeful to see in the 2025 legislative session is a return to this issue of addressing tenant rights, homelessness prevention, and homelessness services, making sure that we have enough investments for people who are experiencing homelessness to find shelter, to find the resources that they need. And then another thing that we ought to look at too is not just within the city of Portland or the city of Grants Pass or the state of Oregon. It's also really important to look at other areas within the United States as well who also have populations of people who are experiencing homelessness. There was a case, not a case, but a program in Denver, Colorado, where they created sort of a guaranteed basic income program where they gave money to people experiencing homelessness, no strings attached. And what they saw was that there was a huge increase in the amount of security that people felt, right? Then there was a notable decline in homelessness in Denver. There was a proportion of people who participated in this program that found themselves having a more stable place to stay. Number of nights that were spent in shelters decreased by half. I mean, these are other things that we also need to be looking at in other jurisdictions to see what's working, what's not working, and, you know, have those conversations in Oregon's legislature, but then also other cities across the state.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking today with Lauren Naldoza from the Oregon Food Bank. Lauren, if people would like to find out more about the Oregon Food Bank and how they might support it if they're interested, how can they find out about the Oregon Food Bank?
They can go to OregonFoodBank.org. We have a number of events for community members. We have events called Ending Hunger Power Nights, where we host virtually across the state a number of different events for people to get engaged and learn more about policy, not just hunger policy, but you know, housing policy, a whole slew of other areas that we see as root causes of hunger. So OregonFoodBank.org is the place to go. And yeah, we have those events pretty regularly. There's ways to get engaged to volunteer, pick up a shift for repacking. And you know, either in our headquarters in Northeast or in one of our regional food bank partners organizations across the state. We partner with 1,400 different organizations across the state, and getting engaged in any part of the state you live in is a possibility.
Great. Well, Lauren, thanks so much for being on Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Pathways, a show featuring conversations with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. Join me, host Paul O'Brien, or my co-host Donald Altman, every